Hi, this is The Takeaway for Tuesday, June 13th, 2017.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Huckenberry. Thanks so much for listening. Well, there's the easy thing.
We don't have to talk about this unbelievable victory. Wasn't it unbelievable? So we don't have to say it again. But it's going to be an unbelievable victory, actually, when we get it through the Senate, and there's so much spirit there.
So much spirit. And then there's the hard thing.
I don't envy the majority leader in trying to cobble together 50 votes for a bill. I think it is extremely difficult, and it's even more difficult if you care about maintaining coverage.
The boyish enthusiasm of President Donald Trump and the very, very hard-fought demoralization of Senator Susan Collins, a Republican from Maine, who is hard at work on a Senate version of a health care bill. It's turning out to take more than a Trump rally, some bluster, bluntness, and bludgeoning to get a health care bill that will actually replace Obamacare. The House got a shot, but they're far from success. The Senate wants to have a go, and they've largely done so out of the public eye, choosing not to hold any hearings as they attempt to cobble together the necessary votes from their 52 senators, and largely without the input of the Democratic colleagues. Takeaway Washington correspondent Todd Zwillick has a lot of experience watching the messy legislative process, especially when it comes to health care. Todd, is this very healthy for you to be doing, paying so closely attention to this here?
Well, it feels like a reprise of a process from back in 2009 in some ways, just because there's so much attention on healthcare. But John, this process really is far, far different from the way the ACA, Obamacare, got passed in 2009. What we've seen over the last several weeks in the Senate is a small group of senators going behind closed doors and really meeting three times a week amongst themselves, shooting around ideas. Most of those details have not leaked to the public at all. They have not leaked to the press. And they even haven't leaked to other Republican senators. And you're hearing more and more frustration, certainly among Democrats, as you can imagine, but even among Republicans too. And it's really a lot different from what it was a couple of years ago. We can talk about that. But let me give you a flavor of some of the frustration that's been boiling over among senators as a couple of Republicans, a smallish group of Republicans, maybe a dozen or so, put together what Mitch McConnell says will be their health care proposal. Here's Claire McCaskill. She's a Democrat. She's from Missouri. And she had some pretty harsh words in a hearing the other day.
We have no idea what's being proposed. There's a group of guys in a back room somewhere that are making these decisions. There were no hearings in the House. I mean, listen, this is hard to take because I know we made mistakes on the Affordable Health Care Act, Mr. Secretary. And one of the criticisms we got over and over again that the vote was partisan. Well, you couldn't have a more partisan exercise than what you're engaged in right now.
Now, John, Claire McCaskill went on for several minutes with her criticism of the process, and you might expect that from Democrats. It's true that Democrats have not really been involved in this repeal and replace effort at all. They signaled very early in this process that politically, in terms of policy, they just weren't interested in participating in a repeal of their health care bill.
Although I'm a little surprised that she did the mea culpa. We made mistakes. That was a little surprising.
Well, Democrats have had to acknowledge some of those mistakes because there are parts of Obamacare that aren't working well. Premiums are going up in many places. There are counties across America that have only one or in some cases no insurers who are covering Obamacare-approved plans. So they better acknowledge some shortcomings because it's a law that really needs to be fixed. I think the question among Democrats is why not fix it instead of do a repeal and replace? And we've talked about that. But it's not just Democrats who are angry about this process, John. It's Republicans, too. Ron Johnson is a conservative Republican. He was a Tea Party Republican. He's from Wisconsin. And a bunch of us asked him yesterday how curious he is about what's in the bill that his party is putting together and what he would like to see in it.
All of it. I want to know exactly what's going to be in the Senate bill. I don't know yet.
What does it tell you, though, Senator, that someone like yourself who's going to be voting on it still doesn't know the details?
It's not a good process.
But they're going to see the bill, they'll read the bill, they'll know the details, and then they'll vote.
That's true, except when you compare it to how different this process is for how the Affordable Care Act passed back in 2009, John, the differences are really remarkable. Do keep in mind when you're talking about healthcare, people like to throw around the idea this affects 1/6 of the economy. Healthcare is a giant industry in America. The truth is that the Obamacare exchanges are a lot smaller than 1/6. It's only probably 7 to 10% of patients. But don't forget, there are 50 million Americans on Medicaid, and there's potentially a rollback of the Medicaid expansion at stake here. So it really is tens of millions of people and hundreds of billions of dollars that are at stake. So it really is a big deal. And John, back in 2009, you know, there were two Senate committees that marked up the ACA over a total of 21 days of public legislative markups. There were dozens of other hearings. There were bipartisan talks going on in senators' offices that yours truly staked out for months at a time, as people negotiated with moderate Republican senators like Olympia Snowe from Maine, to an extent Susan Collins, and even a couple of others. None of that is going on now. What you're seeing now is a process that's hidden from all Democrats, hidden from many Republicans, even though they do say they've received some loose outlines of what's being potentially proposed here as Republicans talk to the CBO. And then the plan is to take it right to the floor if there are 50 votes and just vote on it. It's very different.
Right. But do we have any suspicion whatsoever? And your nose is good at this. Are they dealing with any sort of innovation, any kind of new? I mean, we know they're not going to come up with a single payer plan, right?
Right. Definitely.
Okay. So we can rule that out. I talked to a really interesting local legislator from, I believe, the state of Utah or Arizona, who talked about just basically extending Medicaid, just extending Medicaid, just poof, do that, and, you know, make that work. I mean, any innovation, any surprises? Could they possibly surprise us after all this?
You are seeing more and more Republicans, especially governors across the country, who found religion on Medicaid. The Obamacare legislation, the ACA, gave states, as we know, the ability to expand Medicaid. That was controversial. More and more states have done it, and it's really helped cover millions of people who didn't have coverage before. Now, in terms of innovation, we just don't know. But we do know that Medicaid continues to be controversial. We have a couple of broad ideas of what Senator McConnell and his group of Republican negotiators might be planning. The Republican Senate bill appears to want to roll back the expansion of Medicaid under the ACA, but do it much more slowly than the House. There's been a lot of pressure from governors and from senators that represent those states where Medicaid has been expanded not to cut it off, not even quickly, if they're going to roll back the Medicaid expansion, which is still Republican dogma, to do it much more slowly. It looks like they're going to maintain some of those tax credit subsidies to help people buy insurance, but we don't know how much that will cost, what the subsidies will be worth, or who will get them. There also appears to be some effort to protect guarantees so that insurance companies can't charge you more for pre-existing conditions, but it's far from clear about how that would work, because there's been one or two leaks from one or two senators that there may still be allowed a rollback of essential health benefits where states can opt out of guaranteed, you know, things like maternity care or cancer screening or other tests, still allow states to back out of that, and then insurers could cherry pick patients. It's all really, really unclear. Let me bring you back to Susan Collins, who we heard from at the top. She's a big Republican supporter of Medicaid. Her state has a lot of poverty, expanded Medicaid. And I asked her about sort of the apple cart effect, you know, how hard it is to get a divided Republican conference, even to get to 50 votes here.
It is not an easy task. And you are right that the caucus is not united. There are many members who represent states that expanded Medicaid. And I'm sure their governors are not real thrilled with the idea of the funding for that being abruptly cut off or even phased out over a year or two.
So this can't just boil down to that issue that Susan Collins enumerated there.
No, it doesn't boil down to one single issue. That issue is critical, by the way. It boils down to a lot of issues, and many of which we do not have the answers to yet. What is the overall cost of a Senate proposal? How many people who have coverage now would go without it in 10 years? And then at the basis of all of that, of course, is Republican policy preferences and Republican orthodoxy. Look, this has never been a party that has ever been in favor of large government programs for health care or really for anything else. And now they're confronting, John, the politics of having to keep them.
But listen to Collins. Would the GOP actually, and again, I'm not editorializing here, would the GOP actually put up a bill that would allow a state to opt out of prenatal care or oncology screening so that if you have like a tumor in your lung, the hospital would say you got to go to another state?
The politics of health care have flipped, and the politics of the Affordable Care Act have flipped. And, John, you're getting to some of the essential questions for Republicans now. After attacking the Affordable Care Act for those many 7 years since it was passed and having the public on their side because the law was pretty unpopular, all of a sudden it's polling well above 50%. Voters are saying, wait a second, now that you're going to take something away, maybe you should fix the Affordable Care Act. Don't get rid of it. And even though the rhetoric of repeal and replace flies around Capitol and over the news airwaves, really we might not be talking about an abject repeal in the end. And you've gotten to the heart of the political dilemma here.
You know, now
and I will say one last thing. You ask about essential health benefits. Republicans have committed themselves to lowering premiums, and they're trying to find ways to make sure that that premium charge, that bill that people are paying, goes down. It's not easy. And for every Susan Collins that they satisfy, they get a conservative senator who says, I'm not going for it.
Well, I'll tell you, now that you mentioned the allowing states to opt out of something like oncology screening, I know why they're keeping it a secret. It makes perfect sense. Todd, thank you so much.
My pleasure.
Todd Zwillig, Takeaway Washington correspondent.
This is The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International in collaboration with The New York Times and WGBH Boston Public Radio.
Bloody standoff in Venezuela for nearly 3 months now. The opposition to President Nicolas Maduro has been growing. Demonstrations have become larger with a broader sector of the population participating. 60 people have died, including 18-year-old Armando Canizales, a talented violist who was a standout student from a state-run music program for the poor. Armando's success represented the promises made to the poor and the vision of a socialist cultural paradise imagined by the late President Hugo Chavez. But Armando's death in the streets represents just how much those promises have all been dashed by the reality of oil running out, the corruption of the Maduro government, and the general chaos in Venezuela. Prominent jailed opposition leader Leopoldo Lopez has called for the anti-government protests to continue until demands to release political prisoners and to hold new presidential elections are met. On Monday, the Venezuelan court rejected efforts to stop the president from rewriting the Constitution. Hannah Dreyer, former Venezuela correspondent for the Associated Press, is joining us now with the latest from Caracas. Hannah, good to have you back.
Good to be with you, John.
So, again, this is in slow-mo, a country coming apart, but is it speeding up here? What's changed?
Yes, it doesn't feel quite so slow motion these days. The main thing that struck me is that the capital city is shut down every day lately. There are protests that are ending in bloody clashes with the police, and this is happening every other day, every day. So kids aren't going to school. They're going out and protesting. People aren't going to work. They're either staying in their homes or they're also going out to these protests. And the entirety of the government seems to be focused on just trying to calm the unrest.
The chaos in a place like Libya is sustained by a certain amount of oil that could be sold. Venezuela, in theory, has the same kind of opportunity, but even that isn't keeping things afloat here. What's making the country run at all?
People here are always asking me, how long can this go on? How is it possible that it's gone on for so long? And I also wonder that. I mean, everywhere you go right now, you're crossing smoldering barricades of trash. The whole city kind of looks like there's almost a war going on. And it's been like this for so long. And I think a lot of it does come down to the oil. That's what's funding the government. Without huge oil reserves, Venezuela has the biggest reserves in the world. There's no way this situation would have lasted. We've been in really a crisis for at least 2 years now.
What do you think of the confrontation between Leopoldo López and Maduro here? New elections, release political prisoners, these demands, etc.
So Leopoldo López has been in jail since 2014 when he led a similar violent protest movement. And he's always been kind of the candidate of the street down here. He's the guy who advocates for big street protests and for just throwing Maduro out of power immediately. So this is a really powerful moment for him. And not only is he calling for new elections, he's calling on the military to openly revolt. He's been smuggling out these videos where he calls on the top brass all the way down to rank and file soldiers to rise up against the government. And that's pretty dramatic.
And not only is it dramatic, it's also the model in Latin America and particularly in South America for all the governments there, with the exception probably of Chile. The military sort of holds the cards. If they go with the protesters, then it's over. Where does the military stand on this?
I mean, that is the key question right now. The military has played a huge role all over Latin America, and especially in Venezuela. Hugo Chavez himself came to fame when he tried to stage a coup when he was part of the military. There are signs that the military is wavering. We've seen documents that show that several officers have been arrested for trying to incite rebellion. And I recently talked to a rank-and-file soldier. He's not ready yet to rise up against the government, but he does say that he's very scared when he goes out to these protests. Because, I mean, it's dangerous for the guys on the front lines on both sides. The military is also sometimes taking fire and sometimes getting injured.
Now, I announced that you're a former Venezuela correspondent for the Associated Press. You will soon be saying goodbye to Venezuela. Is that the case?
That's right. I'm wrapping up my stint here, and I'm going back to the U.S. later this month.
So in the time that you've been down there, let's do a tale of two sources. Who is someone you've spoken to who you know is a survivor from this?
There are some people who I've been friends with since I've gotten here who are my age, who are young professionals. Most of them have left. Almost all of my friends here have left as brain drain, you know, grows. I do have one friend who opens fancy restaurants, and she's actually been doing great because there's still a class of people here who are getting rich off of the revolution, basically. So they still want to go out and buy, you know, duck salad, have fancy meals at a nice place. And my friend has been kind of cleaning up, doing that kind of work.
Wow.
Although she feels very ambivalent about it now, with the protests especially.
And who is most in harm's way as you leave?
Well, yesterday I told the woman who does maintenance in my building that I'm leaving, and she immediately started crying. And she said, things aren't going to get better. Everybody's leaving, and this is going to last for years and years. Like a lot of older people here, most of her family has left. So her daughters are gone. Her grandchildren are gone. And she is living right now in a neighborhood that's just racked with violence. And there are daily protests that keep her shut in there. She's afraid to leave the house to go get food. She often doesn't come to work because she can't kind of traverse the city with the protests going on. Or she has to wait for her government bag of food that comes kind of sporadically. I worry a lot for the older people who are still here, who aren't trying to leave, but are just kind of in an abandoned city.
Do you feel you're abandoning them?
It's a heavy thing to leave, especially because there are so few correspondents here now. I think I was actually the last U.S. correspondent to get a permanent accreditation to report here. The government isn't really allowing in new journalists. So that, more than anything, is weighing heavily on me. I don't know who's going to replace me.
A portrait of a country in chaos from Hannah Dreyer once again, former Venezuela correspondent for the Associated Press in Caracas. Thanks so much, Hannah.
Thank you, John.
In our series on obesity this month, some of the same hyper-consciousness about body image we've talked about with and about women is as true for men, especially gay men. Here's writer Louis Peitzman.
I wrote a piece a few years ago that was talking about how, you know, I'd grown up in a liberal community and I'd never really dealt with serious homophobia growing up, but fatness was always stigmatized. And so for me, it was a lot harder growing up fat than it was growing up gay.
Louis Peitzman is senior editor for BuzzFeed News based in New York City, where he says it's always open season on fat jokes, and the stigma of being fat endured by men is perceived as being no big deal.
One of the key things for me is that there are a lot of liberal, open-minded people, progressive people who, you know, would never dream of making homophobic comments or racist comments or any of these things, but will still make fat jokes because that is culturally accepted. And so I think for a lot of people, like, fatness is one area that you can always mock without repercussion.
But there are repercussions, and those repercussions, Louis Peitzman says, are psychologically costly.
What people are dealing with much more than sugary cereal ads are, you know, the idea that if you're fat, you are worthless. I mean, that is a much more damaging message to a child's psyche. And there's much more reinforcement of that aspect of things, of being shamed for it, than there is of the idea that somehow if you are fat, you will be funnier and happier. Especially for women, especially for gay men, they're dealing with a different level of treatment, of rudeness, of something that a lot of straight men are not dealing with.
Why'd you change?
Because, I mean, for me, it was more about inactivity. And so I, you know, was really just kind of had a lot of negative habits of staying inside and really just coping with food and not doing anything else. And so when I decided to become more active and walk a lot more every day and eat better, it wasn't so much about losing weight as it was about breaking that cycle of inactivity, of you know, depression in that way, the manifestation of depression.
How do people treat you now?
You know, you get a lot of comments that are odd. There's really no winning in a lot of ways. You know, you get a lot of body comments. There's the subtle suggestion that you maybe lost too much weight or that you are losing weight the wrong way or that you are, you know, it comes from the same place of this sort of seemingly well-intentioned, like, I'm concerned about your health thing.
Within the gay male community, is there pressure to maintain a certain look, body style that comes from either within that culture or somewhere else in culture?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think part of the divide between women and men and straight men in particular, that, you know, we see a lot of cultural images of heavier straight men with, you know, their skinny wives, and that's just sort of part of the culture, and we accept that. But for women and for gay men and for other groups of people, being overweight is not considered something to joke about in a fun way. And I think that a lot of that has to do with the fact that the people who are making the judging comments and who are you know, maybe the most concerned with that are men. And so if you date men, whether you are a straight woman or a gay man, you are dealing with a very judgmental culture and a very body conscious, critical culture. And so I think that that's where a lot of that comes from, is just being surrounded by men. And I think that, you know, one of the keys here is that, you know, whether you are a young person who is, you know, at quote unquote a healthy weight or whatever, you know, your doctor tells you is a healthy weight, or an overweight person, you want to be growing up in a community that supports you regardless, because you cannot always control these things. You know, if it were as simple as everyone losing weight and being what society wants them to be, that's just not going to happen. That's not the way that things are. And so I think it's more important to create a society that welcomes people of different sizes and abilities and treats them with respect is really the key issue there.
Louis Peitzman is a senior editor for BuzzFeed News.
The whole war on obesity is a war on people.
It's not going to be easy. It's going to be an uphill battle.
We are really not healthy.
I want to be taken seriously, no matter what my weight.
So you're always in, like, this low-level crisis, pitting your regular bills against whether or not you're going to buy healthy food for your kids.
So obesity is a complex disease.
The question is, do we have an environment that supports responsible decision?
And is a greater public health challenge than anything else, in any virus, any other disease, and even terrorism.
We conclude our look at the economic and social forces underpinning one of this country's biggest health epidemics, obesity. One of the many voices we've heard over the past week and a half, yours have been loud and clear and true. Gaining weight and trying to lose it has been a lifelong struggle for so many of you. Bloomington, Illinois. As a woman in my early 30s, being overweight very much changes how men in particular interact with me. I'm overlooked, and while not directly harassed or disrespected, I'm routinely ignored for thinner, more conventionally attractive women, and other women seem to see me as older, safer, more comforting. Kent, Ohio. When I'm over 35 BMI, I seem to disappear. When I get close to a BMI of 25, suddenly people see me. They make eye contact, hold doors. I don't believe it's intentional. 2 months ago, I had bariatric surgery to lose weight once and for all. I did it mostly for my health, but also for my career.
My name is Gail, and I'm calling from Sauk Rapids, Minnesota. And I happen to be a blind person. I've joined Weight Watchers, but a lot of the stuff isn't available to me in a form accessible to me. As far as the books and things like that. I do the best I can. That's the best I can do.
Even where some of you have had success in weight loss, it often comes at a price. The physical side effects of shedding the weight can be debilitating.
I'm Helena. I'm calling from Mamaroneck. Doctors put me on massive doses of T4, and even though I lost several teeth and all my nails turned black, they tried to use the hormones to force my body to lose weight. I got very sick from it. And I think doctors need to know that we shouldn't be using hormones to force people to lose weight. We should just be balancing hormones. And it's just always up the meds. And I think it's making a lot of women sick.
Hi, my name is Carol. I'm calling from Charlotte, North Carolina. I have been obese or battling weight since I was 8 years old. I am now in my mid-50s. I do have a problem losing weight. I was able to lose weight once about 8 years ago by injecting myself with HCG. It was very dangerous. I ended up losing an ovary because of it, and that was the only time my body was able to access and burn its fat storage.
Surgery is for some the only recourse toward fulfilling the goal of a healthier future. For most of our friends in the takeaway community who reached out, the ends did justify the means.
My name is Gina. I'm calling from Wolf Center, Washington. I've had obesity surgery, and I have to tell you, going from a size 18 to a size 6 has had a tremendous positive impact on my self-confidence. I wouldn't have thought that it would make that much difference, but the difference was huge. And I wish the government would fund it for more people. I'm much more active, healthier. It's just been such a godsend.
Obesity is perhaps the most familiar tale of coming to terms with unrealistic societal norms. Narratives of self-acceptance that can take years before leaving people content and truly satisfied. Gonzales, Florida. I've been overweight my whole life. Every diet, exercise plan, and medical weight loss approach has never worked. The couple of times in my life where I did lose a bunch of weight was also the most miserable. Why is it so wrong to just accept people the way they are? Tonight at 7 p.m. Eastern Time, feminist writer Lindy West moderates an event in the WNYC Green Space about what it's like to be fat in America. It's called The Other F Word, The Politics of Being Fat. And it's going to be a barn burner, an honest and hilarious conversation with Ashley Nell Tipton, winner of Project Runway's Season 14, and writer Tamika Anderson. Tickets are sold out, but you can still tune in. We'll be streaming the event live from our Facebook page and our website. Again, it starts at 7 p.m. Eastern Time tonight. We hope you'll join us. Now a story of being lost in the U.S. criminal justice system. On Monday afternoon, Jerry Hartfield became found. He was released from Hutchins State Jail in Dallas, Texas, after spending 41 years behind bars for the alleged murder of a woman named Eunice Lowe in 1976 when his fingerprints were found near the scene and he confessed to the crime. He was convicted by a jury and sentenced to death. Hartfield, who is classified by the prison system as intellectually disabled, says today that he was coerced into confessing and that he is innocent. In 1980, the Texas Court of Criminal Appeals overturned his murder conviction because of a question of jury bias and ordered a new trial. But prosecutors chose to, in effect, disobey those orders. They asked the courts to keep the conviction. The courts refused. But they also asked the governor to commute Hartfield's sentence. And he agreed, despite the fact there wasn't a valid conviction of murder against him anymore. Jeff Newberry has been Jerry Hartfield's attorney since 2012 and is a legal clinic supervisor at the University of Houston. Andrew Cohen is senior editor at the Marshall Project, who has been following this case for 5 years and made it the subject of this week's Case in Point. He says the decision by the prosecution allowed years to go by without a trial, without a commutation. True legal limbo.
What they tried to do was to keep the conviction, but somehow say that they were satisfied with it being a life sentence and not the death penalty. In other words, they tried to get around the new trial order. So that complicated things. And one of the things they did was to try to go to the governor and get this commutation of the death penalty to a life sentence. They went through the court system to try to sort of shape the nature of the case, and they went to the governor to try to shape the nature of the case. And basically, both of the branches responded. The governor got this commutation, although it came too late, and the courts ultimately said, you know what? No, you can't do it this way. This man deserves a new trial, and he should get a new trial, and you can't take part of the old trial and get rid of the other part of the old trial. And that is where the confusion rested. Prosecutors thought that the commutation from the governor took care of it. The governor's office certainly thought that the commutation took care of it. Jerry Hartfield was at a minimum confused about his situation. The jailers thought that the commutation maybe took care of it. Nobody understood that the court order granting the new trial trumped the commutation. And that was a mystery, basically, in the case for, 23 years, from 1983 until 2006, when Jerry Hartfield had the good luck to run into at least one or maybe two fellow inmates who helped him begin to look anew at the status of his case.
Why, under any circumstances, would a lawyer be allowed to raise his or her hand and say, hey, I have a great idea, why don't we just commute the sentence and pretend like this second trial hasn't even been granted? Jeff, how did that happen, and why was it permitted to happen?
Well, before the order for a new trial became final, that would have been a permissible way to take care of this one particular error, the jury selection error. The court still would have had to reconsider the other issues. But before that order became final, that would have been a permissible way to deal with this. The thing is, they didn't do it until after the order became final, and I don't know why anyone would think it was permissible at that point.
Andrew, how much flexibility exists in this period of time when a ruling comes down and a lawyer raises his or her hand and says, actually, here's this really clever way of doing the same thing?
You know, you're asking the question and you're answering it. It is permissible. And had it been done in the right manner, in the right time frame, Jerry Hartfield would be serving out his life sentence and there would be no controversy. There would be a court order sanctifying everything. The commutation, or in other words, would be valid, one or the other. But you had neither. And so that's where the confusion lay. I mean, part of the reason I picked this case and have been following this case for so many years is everybody dropped the ball for a generation. Somebody had to do it right, I guess is the way to put it, and nobody did it right, and then nobody knew that nobody had done it right for all these years while this man sat in a Texas prison without a conviction against him. I mean, that's the thing that makes this unique. This man has been in prison in Texas since 1980, or 1983, depending on which date you want to look at, without a valid conviction of murder against him. And then when it came up again in 2006, and basically for the last 10 years, all of a sudden, Texas officials have been citing all these procedures to essentially block Jerry Hartfield in one form or another from getting some sort of relief, from getting some sort of remedy. So the procedures were basically used against him twice. They were used against him at the confusion in 1983, and then for the past many years, they've been used against him as a roadblock to try to get him the relief that he ultimately got in January.
If someone had taken this case and done what you had done 35 years earlier, would Mr. Hartfield be on the streets today?
it's hard to say for certain what the result would have been, because it's the delay that necessitates the release. Because the delay between the order for a new trial and the new trial hamstrung his attorneys in their efforts to defend him against those charges. Lots of evidence was lost. I mean, the murder weapon was lost. Other key pieces of evidence was lost. And so without knowing exactly when these pieces of evidence were lost and when these witnesses died, it's really impossible to predict what the outcome would have been at some earlier point in history.
And let me just interject for a second, John, and make a point about the irony of all of this. So Jerry Hartsfield is told in 1980 he should have a new trial. And then in 1983, it's formally ensured that he's supposed to get a new trial. And then nothing happens for 23 years. And then he starts digging around, and he starts asking questions, and he starts filing motions, pro se motions, because he doesn't have a lawyer. And then finally he gets a lawyer. And it takes essentially 11 years. This is a crazy, obvious violation of the speedy trial right. The irony in this case is that had prosecutors not fought him, had Texas state attorneys not fought him in 2006 or 7 or 8 or 9 or 10 or 11 and said that his claims were bogus, the value, the strength of his speedy trial claim would have been weakened. Because in the end, in January of 2017, what the court said was that they weren't going to start the clock on the speedy trial claim from 1980 or 1983, but rather from 2006. So you have a situation where ultimately, had Texas simply acknowledged the mistake and said, yeah, you know, this is an oversight, this is an innocent situation of confusion, we're going to immediately try Jerry Hartsfield again, and we're going to do the best we can with the evidence, I think that the situation, the outcome here might have been very different.
Andrew and Jeff, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Andrew Cohen is the senior editor at the Marshall Project and author of Case in Point, and Jeff Newberry is Jerry Hartsfield's attorney since 2012. He's also legal clinic supervisor at the University of Houston. A few weeks back, the emotional power of some of our one-on-one race conversations that we've been having periodically motivated listener Allison Fornes to write to us, wanting to share a conversation she's always wanted to have with her mother, Julia. Julia never really told the story of her upbringing as a young Puerto Rican woman to her daughter, Allison. In 1956, at just 6 years old, Julia was sent from Puerto Rico to an orphanage in Connecticut. Because of racial tensions in the area in 1956, Julia was discouraged from carrying on her traditions to be a more desirable adoptee for a family. She spent much of her life trying to pass as anything but Puerto Rican. Allison knew her mother's struggles with acceptance in America were very different from her own. When she listened to some of our race discussions on The Takeaway, she started to wonder if it would be liberating for her mom to open up about what she went through as a young girl. And as you'll hear, it was more than just liberating. It was a takeaway gift from daughter to mother.
I think that started when I first came from Puerto Rico, and being a ward of the state for all my life, I used to want to have a nice family to be a part of growing up, but it didn't happen. And I was told the reason for that from the social workers in the state of Connecticut. They said that it was because I was Puerto Rican. Families only wanted white, you know, Caucasian American children. From that point on, my friends, my Puerto Rican friends and myself, we all decided being Puerto Rican was not a very good identity to go with. So we all tried to fit in otherwise by saying that we're either Italian, anything other than Puerto Rican. At the time, the racism was really pretty bad. And right up to when I went back to school in college, I still had the same problems saying that I was Puerto Rican. Also, when I got married, my husband said, you know, don't tell anybody you're Puerto Rican. So I kept it under wraps.
Yeah.
It was obviously never a secret to me. That's why I think it came as such a surprise when I realized that. And I think at the time, I wondered, were you trying to be white?
I wasn't, actually. Just anything other than being Puerto Rican. I don't think I would say I'm trying to be white. No, I don't think that ever I just didn't want anyone to know I was Puerto Rican, that's all. For instance, when I was living in Queens, I went to look at an apartment, and the family went on and counted off all the different ethnic groups that they didn't want to rent to. But because I looked like them, they rented to me. Mm-hmm. I did not say, you know, I'm Puerto Rican, because I knew that I was I would not be able to rent their apartment.
Having my own children, you being a grandparent now, I think about what it was like for you to be a little girl, to sort of come up with all of these projections, the contrast between what your life was like when you were just a little girl born and raised in Puerto Rico for the short time that you were there, and then coming over here as a young girl. And so I think I'm curious about what was it like for you trying to find your true self when you had all these projections about coming at you about what you were because you were Puerto Rican?
At first, I was extremely happy. I remember, you know, going into the orphanage and just all smiles. And, you know, I only spoke Spanish. And I made friends with a couple of other Puerto Rican girls that had also just come from Puerto Rico. And I remember how I was able to speak Spanish to them, and I was really happy. But then that was short-lived because the nuns said, no, you're not allowed to speak your native language. You cannot do that. So every time we would, you know, we'd be in a little group talking in our own native language, and if we got caught, we'd be severely, you know, really punished by smacking our hand with a paddle if we were caught talking Spanish. So at first, I had no problem. I mean, I just loved who I was. And then after, you know, all the signs, there used to be signs that was in Hartford, and it was something about speaking English only, you know. And I remember people, you know, yelling to go back to Puerto Rico, because there was a lot of us coming to the mainland at that time. So, you know, being teased and, it was just a pretty nasty time as a child. So I learned by that experience, it wasn't a good thing to be Puerto Rican at that time anyway. The more I dealt with that kind of racism, the more I felt, yeah, my identity of self, my self-identity was just destroyed. I didn't feel very good about myself, and that lasted forever. Mm. Actually, this is kind of funny, because it wasn't until Jennifer Lopez, when she became so popular, that's when I realized, hey, I'm Puerto Rican too. This is a good thing, you know, and I was able to come out and say who I am. I am from the Caribbean. I am Puerto Rican. I am who I am, you know. Mm. Now I am very proud of who I am. But it took me a long, long time. Allison, you went back a couple of times. You went back with your husband and Radcliffe.
And I think each time, part of what I'm doing is, can I sort of warming up to the place and finding the ways in which, you know, I can make it my own as well. I was with some college friends, and we went to Maricao, which is the village in which you were born and raised. And I was shocked to discover, like, there was this park or some kind of park-like thing, and had this structure that said, that had the Fornes name on it. And even there was a coffee harvest festival, and it was beautiful. There was great music and dancing and really thick black coffee being served. And at some point in the middle of there was an announcement calling for, in Spanish, calling for somebody with a Fornes last name. And I honestly, there was something, it was actually almost too much for me. My friends tried to encourage me, and at the time I felt, you know, it was kind of a missed opportunity that I regret a little bit. But I could feel both the sort of this intensity of what it meant to be in this place that was home, an ancestral home, and also feel like, oh, I'm not sure that I could be welcome or connected. Like, how do I reach into that space? Yeah. I don't think I've said that before.
I still haven't gone back yet. But then I have been able to get in touch with my my family, my biological family in Puerto Rico. Everybody's in Puerto Rico except for my cousin. And it feels so good to know that, you know, my cousins, they accept me quite warmly, you know, mm-hmm. As if I'd never left the family. Mm. And it really makes me feel so good. And because of that, I really embrace my nationality.
That was Allison Fornes, an education consultant based in Salem, Massachusetts. She talked with her mother, Julia Fornes. If you want to take part in our Uncomfortable Truth series, head to thetakeaway.org/truths. Tell us who you'd like to have a conversation about race with. It could be a family member, a friend, or a coworker. Anyone. Over the last week, we've been hearing perspectives about obesity in America, and we want to thank you for being a part of the conversation.
My name is Anisha. I'm calling from Pawleys Island, South Carolina. I have always been very active, but I'm now 50 years old and about 225 pounds. I'm high blood pressure and diabetic. Goal this year is to lose about 75 pounds. We'll see what happens.
You can hear all of that series at thetakeaway.org/obesity. Thanks for listening. I'm John Hockenberry, and this is The Takeaway.
Support for The Takeaway comes from the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia. The Takeaway's resilience reporting is supported by the Rockefeller Foundation. For more, go to rockfound.org. Curious.com, working to help people reclaim between 5 and 30 minutes a day to learn something new and build their CQ or curious quotient through the game of lifelong learning. More at curious.com/PRI. And Staples. Staples offers copy and print solutions for businesses, including color copies, presentations, and promotional products. More at Staples stores or at staples.com. Staples, it's pro time.
At Radiolab, we love nothing more than nerding out about science, neuroscience, chemistry.
But we do also like to get into other kinds of stories. Stories about policing or
politics,
country music,
hockey,
sex of bugs.
Regardless of whether we're looking at science or not science, we bring a rigorous curiosity to get you the answers.
And hopefully make you see the world anew.
Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know.
Wherever you get your podcasts.